John, I am confused. You're not confused, you're discombobulated. My understanding of your words is that goals are to be discouraged, but you have the goal of a nuns' monastery in London, had the goal of a retreat with ensuite. Please unconfuse me. Please provide the practical steps of having goals and operating in the now. So, when you're on retreat, you have no goals. But on Saturday or Sunday, when you leave, please have the goal of getting to the airport in time. If you just wander to the airport and the immigration officer asks you, "Madam, where are you going?" You say, "I don't know. I have no goal. I'm just being here." And then you'll be taken to the funny farm because there is a time for having no goals. Now, on retreat. And there is a time for doing something. So that is the simile of the soldier in the British Army Second World War, surrounded by Japanese troops. And about six of them, a couple of hundred Japanese troops. And it was death. What would you do? So he decided to be the hero, the Bruce Willis. Do I look like Bruce Willis? Because sometimes people say I've got a bald head. No? Oh, never mind. But anyway, he said, "Let's fight our way out. Who knows? One of us might survive. And if we don't, we'll take many of the enemy into death with us." That is the manly thing to do. It's amazing, it was like an English teacher. But anyway, but anyway, he was really sort of strong, and he was going to serve his country and die for his... I don't know what he was dying for, but anyway, die for something. So, the captain said, "No, we will not try and fight our way out." And he ordered everybody, this is a war, in the army, you have to follow orders. It's not like being in a monastery. So, you have to follow orders. So, the captain said, "We won't fight our way out. Instead, we will all sit down and make a cup of tea." The great tradition of the English army. When there's a lot of trouble, you're about to be defeated and killed, sit down and have a cup of tea. He thought that was the craziest thing ever. And how can you think of having a cup of tea when you're about to die? Just, you know, all the bullet holes, all the tea will come out. I watched too many cartoons as a kid. But he had to do that. He said it was the craziest thing he'd ever done in his life. So he thought. But it's actually what saved his life. Because there they were, sitting down, having a cup of tea. The scout came back and said, "Put everything away quickly. The enemy has moved. There's a way out." And they all crawled out through that gap in the encircling forces. And that's how they survived. That's how you could tell the story. And that's a brilliant story, like real life. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. Relax, have a cup of tea. And when there's something to do, do it. But most of people in life... oh my goodness, they don't know how to do nothing. So even meditation, that's something more to do. Another goal. Have you achieved your goals in meditation yet? How many times have you been coming here? So, this is the problem here. We don't know how to let go. And so, yeah, it's great having, not a nuns' monastery in London. Do you want one in London? No. No. How about, where else? In Manchester? Hastings, in the seaside. Near the sea. What about in the sea? Because they had these, I remember, these old forts in the sea, which people actually just, the old oil rigs, which got abandoned. How about getting a boat? a boat, because then you could sail the boat over to Perth for every rains retreat. On the way, you can give a retreat in Singapore. And when you're on the boat, anyone who sort of eats in the evening or speaks too loud, they can actually walk the plank. I watched too many pirate movies as a kid. So anyway, it's some place which is nice and quiet and cheap. That's what Ajahn Chakra used to ask me when I used to go out to get some stuff for the monastery. He said, get the cheapest and the best. Some people are very hard to please. So, yes, there is, not all goals to be discouraged, but when the goals, personal goals, yes. Because they just create more sense of self. But service, the goal of service, giving to others, making for a better world. Not by your own goals, becoming enlightened, but by becoming kind. Because that goal of like becoming kind, compassionate, serving, that's a letting go of the sense of self. Personal goals and achievements, that's just enhancing the sense of self. So that's a nice thing to do. Apparently, I haven't seen this because it's supposed to be on some video where, was it the Paralympics or something in London or somewhere, where the Paralympics, someone was running and they fell over. And so somebody stopped and picked them up and they all came over the line together. And I thought that was beautiful. Imagine that happening in the Olympic Games. Usain Bolt going against Sir Venerable Chanda. And he's like, ah, come on. And they just go together. Wouldn't that be wonderful? In a football match, when Manchester United are playing, I don't know, Liverpool or something, and then Manchester United, they scored too many goals, so this is really unfair. So they just let Liverpool score a few more, make it more exciting. Would that be good? That is why Thailand especially keeps on losing. Singapore is not really a good soccer team. There's too many Buddhists on the team. Because Buddhists are compassionate. You know, who wants to disappoint the opposition? Who wants to make whoever Singapore is playing so upset when they lose? So a real Buddhist, playing, say, for Singapore soccer team, would lose on purpose. If they had the ball, they would let go. Come on, if you want it, it's yours. And out of compassion, if they couldn't score a goal, you score an own goal for them. That's Buddhist principles. But it's true. If I was playing in a soccer match, I'd kick the ball anywhere. I wouldn't know where to kick it because I could see no goals. Okay, anyway. So are you more discombobulated, more confused, or less? If less, then. But when you're meditating, especially, when you're meditating, please no goals. That's where you really sort of stuff up and make yourself more tense. My sister is a Christian, but by definition, practices right motivation, speech, action, livelihood, endeavor, and has pretty good meditation. She can see past lives, but still believes in Christianity. Ask her, was she a Christian in a previous life? Or Buddhist in the next life? Can parts of the path be practiced rightly without right view? Can you have jhana without right view? Okay. Hope I don't offend anybody. But, there is circumstantial but pretty strong evidence that Jesus Christ was a Buddhist. That he did actually go to India. I know that some people say, oh, this is just more conspiracy theories, like Elvis Presley is still alive. And but the circumstantial evidence, is number one, we do know as a fact that Buddhism was in Egypt, especially Lower Egypt, and also in Alexandria in the 2nd, 3rd century BCE. That was because there are gravestones over in southern Egypt with Buddhang Savanankachami, Dhammang Savanankachami, Sanghang Savanankachami written on it, and a Dhammachaka wheel. And at that time, Philadelphus Ptolemy, who was the boss in Alexandria, you know, he recorded many Indians who were joining the celebrations at festivals. He didn't say Buddhists, he said Indians, but most Indians at that time followed the Buddhist religion. And there was a strong trade route. And that trade route was, you know, from the west of India, just south of Mumbai, a port called Soparika. And then it went over the Asian Gulf, or Persian Gulf, whatever it's called, so Persian Gulf, to the present town of Aden, which was then Asiaticus Felicitus or something, had a different name, forget what it was now. And that was supposed to be, by historians at the time, full of Indians, Jews, and Greeks. Multicultural hub, because that's where the boats would go in, refuel or whatever, and then they'd go to a port on the south of the Red Sea, which was built by Philadelphus Ptolemy, and that's where the gravestones are. He built that port to accommodate the trade from Asia. And then from there, it went up the at the top of the Red Sea, it went across the very short piece of desert, and then onto the Nile, and then from the Nile, down the Nile, to Alexandria. And from there, that was a distribution point for the whole of Europe, also getting things in from Europe. That is well attested, 2 centuries before Christ. Now, 200 years later, we have Philo of Alexandria, a very famous historian, and when he reported that the life and times of Alexandria, I think it was about 4 AD, 4 of the Common Era. And in there, he reported everything which was going on, and especially there was a monastery of celibate monks and celibate nuns as well. Bald-headed, brown-robed vegetarians, interestingly. And they held a ceremony every moon day. Now, when I read that, that sounded like Buddhist monks and nuns. There's actually a wall. There's a wall between the monk section and the nun section in this monastery. That's actually where they threw the, you know. Now, when I read that, of course, it's English translation. When you have an English translation, sometimes you're not quite sure whether they're translating it accurately or not. But it was interesting enough that when a fellow monk over, this was when I was still in Thailand, he was from Switzerland, and he had learned, he was fluent in ancient Greek. And so when I told him about this, I said, hey, you've got a few minutes, go to the local library and just read it, check it out. Because he practices a monk, a Theravada monk, he actually could actually understand the references. And then when he looked it up, he wrote this letter back to me, which I should have kept, saying, well, you know, when you said this, I thought that was actually Ajahn Brahm being crazy again. But actually, when I looked it up, he said, you know, using the English word, a dead ringer for Buddhist monks. So I'm totally convinced. Because, you know, he knew ancient Greek. There was Buddhist monks in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. 2,013 years ago. So, and actually that was called the Theraputai. And it's very easy to see how P's, B's and V's get interchanged. A good example of that, Benares, Varanasi, in Thai, the Buddha becomes Putta, the D's and T's get interchanged. That's why in Thai it's Putta Jao. Putta is the Buddha, Jao means like Lord, God. So, it's very very possible that that could have been a Theravada monastery, and it's quite convincing it was. And the other interesting fact was Kirov Alexander said there's thousands more of these monks down in Lower Egypt. And that was weird, because Lower Egypt, that was like deserts. And if you go far enough, you know, the origin of the Nile, that's, you know, really sort of, at that particular time, you know, there was nothing much there. Jungles. So at first I thought, hang on, what does this mean? Until you understand the lack of geographical awareness at that time. Lower Egypt meant you go down the Nile, you go down the trade route, the main road, you know, back to India. When it said down that way, it meant down the way the main route, the travel route came, which was to India. So, if Jesus Christ was an interested spiritual seeker, and had this very well regarded monastery in Alexandria, where his parents would have actually gone as refugees, that would be where he would have gone and learned something. And at that particular time, the center of Buddhism in India was in Kashmir. That was the Emperor Kanishka. That's where he had his center of the basically Indian world at the time, where Buddhism was his path. It was Savastivadin tradition, but you know, there wasn't that much difference between the traditions at that time. So, if you're interested, that's where they would go. And there's lots of evidence that that's where he did go. Not convincing, not a smoking gun, but very convincing, probably was. But then people say, well, what about if you look in the Christian Bible? Where is anything which sounds anything like Buddhism? So, then you have a bit more historical evidence, which is that originally there were three threads of Christianity. There was Jewish Christianity, which was just a part of Judaism, nothing extra, you know, when Jesus said he was just a Jew. And that was a legitimate part, you know, of the three threads of Christianity. That got destroyed in 70 AD when the Roman Empire destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And that was the Jewish Christianity disappeared. And the next one was the church in Rome, where Peter went. That was the center of power. And that was organized. And the other one was the Gnostics. Totally disorganized, individual, no hierarchies. And that was Gnostic Christianity. And everybody thought that Gnostic Christianity was totally wiped out without any record. But, as many people find, as Hillary Clinton finds, you cannot delete all your emails. There's always some evidence somewhere left. And that's why some little archaeologist was messing around in Lower Egypt, close to the village of Nag Hammadi, and there he saw somebody lighting a fire with an ancient manuscript. And he was devastated that this was something really important. He gave the farmer or the sheep herd or whatever a lot of money and found that he found this in pots in a cave. And it became what's known as the Gnostic Gospels. What's her name? Elaine Pagels described as suppressed Christianity in her books. And in there, these are supposed to be sayings of Jesus Christ. Ancient, pretty authentic, saying things like, please excuse the masculinity, that's the way they translated it. He who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. That's pretty Buddhist. And just like you hear in what was the one of the sutras where that Brahma and the Buddha said, "Now who's the best?" And Buddha disappears from Brahma. Brahma couldn't disappear from the Buddha. And this is where, this is in Gnostic Gospels, where Brahma or God says, "I am the firstborn. I am the creator, the all-powerful, the omniscient." And then he heard somebody say, "No, you're not." Who said that? Who said that? And the voice said, "There are other beings in this universe of which you have no knowledge of." It's in the Gnostic Gospels, sayings of Jesus Christ of the Gnostic Gospels. Now that is interesting stuff. That may be heretical and really upsets many people, but I think some of the full transcripts of the Gnostic Gospels are actually up in our library in Bodhinyana. But if you just want just a paperback, easy reading, but really fascinating, that's Elaine Pagels, P-A-G-E-L-S, the Gnostic Gospels, G-N-O-S-T-I-C. If you put those together, maybe it was the case. And I really want to prove that, because if we actually prove that, then that Jesus Christ was a Buddhist, then we no longer have to look for property in England. We can have Westminster Cathedral. You can claim that as your rightful property. And in Italy, we could actually take over the Vatican. Because if that's devoted to Jesus and Jesus was a Buddhist, then no problem at all. Please don't get offended. That's, you know, it's only a bit of a joke. But the evidence is actually quite convincing. And sometimes, you know, you want, no, it can't be true. It's possible, probable. You know, all those hermits, the so-called desert fathers, you know, which, you know, did a lot of influence on early Christianity. They were down over in the Lower Egypt. That's where Christian monasticism started from. Why there? Unless that was closest to the Buddhist monks over in India. We weren't so separated. There was a lot of interaction. And even reading people like Pythagoras, who didn't just do his theorem, he was a philosopher. And he said he got nearly all of his philosophy from the Indians. So I love this sort of stuff, because it's like X-Files. The truth is out there. Go and find it. I haven't seen that, but apparently that's what they say. So anyway, wouldn't it be wonderful then, Christians, Buddhists, all the same? But anyway. Yeah. And even reincarnation. Said I'm coming back again. So there's many things. And also, one of my favourite quotes from the Christian Bible. Bible just means book. So the Christian Bible is in the Psalms. That be still and know that thou art God. Samadhi, stillness. Jhanas, peace, bliss. Woohoo. So anyway, there we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how does personal, etc., growth and development tally or fit in with being happy with what we have, our current situation? Personal growth and development causes so much suffering in this world. Number one, people think they're not good enough and you need to develop and change. Personal growth movement. Development. Who says you're not good enough? So, in other words, we try to improve ourselves. Who says you're not good enough? People who do that, they feel that they're not valued. There's something wrong with them. And, you know, that's people who don't develop as they're supposed to. They get isolated and excluded. I was talking with that people who have either physical deformities or disabilities or emotional, mental differences. I shouldn't call them disabilities, differences. And they get measured, stigmatized, and excluded. You're not like us. You are different. So grow out of it, develop. And that causes so much suffering for human beings. I just was talking even today about Richard Branson, who couldn't do maths, he couldn't count. And he got sort of put back, you know, that someone who just couldn't do simple arithmetic. And now he can certainly count all his billions. So if you've got a kid who fails maths, he could be the next Richard Branson. But sometimes when people are different, think differently, do things differently, look different, you know, how often do they get bullied, stigmatized, excluded from our society? And that's all because we have to have personal growth. We have some idea we're supposed to live up to. Look, the other day, a couple of days ago, I took the opportunity to actually go and visit a sick monk, but at the same time, go into the Department of Social Security here in Perth to get a Commonwealth Seniors card. I'm old enough now, I don't get a pension, but I thought it'd be great to have a seniors card, then I can flash it around and get some more respect. I'm only joking. But it was very difficult, because I had to prove who I was. And I haven't been able to do that in 43 years of being a monk. I could say, I'm just a process. I'm just five candles. But that didn't cut any ice with them. So instead, I had to get, they asked me, said, okay, got your passport, that's good, but I need some other identity. Because see your bank card. I haven't got it. Marriage certificate. I haven't got a marriage certificate. Your rental agreement or your house purchase. I haven't got that either. Driving license. No. And there's so much stuff which I haven't got, which means it's so hard to identify you on the system. And they say, well, you know, what's your income? I said, zero. Can't be. You know, how do you live? I said, look at me, very well. So Buddhist monks don't fit in into our society. And so even like Buddhism itself, you know, for getting all tax deductibility or just recognition, they say, are you a religion? Because a religion is supposed to believe in a supernatural being. I say, no. But these days I say, yeah, we are a religion. For tax purposes anyway. So it's very different to actually to fit people in. And sometimes you don't need to fit in. Why should you fit in? You be yourself. Who says what you're supposed to grow? Who sets the standards where you're supposed to be? And sometimes at those standards, they kill people. You can't reach them. You go to a gym. Come on, work out. You're too fat. The last caretaker here, remember Dania? She went to a gym and worked out and she broke her nose. They're very dangerous places, gyms. Many people have accidents there. True. So, what do you mean, growth and development? Can't you just be, instead of trying to achieve something? So that personal development movement, I think that is just saying that you're not good enough. So say, you're good enough. You don't need that. Oh, the joke. The person goes into the bookshop and asks for the self-help section. And the person on the counter said, if I told you, that would defeat the purpose. So they finally found the self-help book and they open it. And it says, find out for yourself. In the first page of the book. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you show us body sweeping technique that you mentioned in your book? Yes, with your body. Many people have been doing that. You can see them with the broom and the little bucket, sweeping the bodies of the little insects. Mindfully and compassionately, body sweeping. Okay, maybe tomorrow or sometime, but it's really long. How much of a hindrance is self-doubt on the path? It's a huge hindrance. That's why today, you know, I told you, you know, that the Buddha said, if you listen carefully to the teachings, you'll become enlightened. But some people say, these days, the time to get enlightenment is gone. All you can do is give donations to build big temples to Maitreya the Buddha. That's ridiculous. The Buddha said, as long as there's the Eightfold Path, which is here today, there will be stream winners, wise returners, non-returners, and arahats, fully enlightened beings. The path is available now. So you don't need to wait till Maitreya the Buddha. But people say, oh, we'll make lots of good karma so we'll get reborn in the Pure Land and be easier there. And I say to them, this is the Pure Land. You've done that. Now practice. It doesn't get better than this. Jhana Grove is the Pure Land. So if a next retreat center I build, or if you build one over in England, call it the Pure Land. So people can go there and say, here we are. And change your name to Maitreya, Bhikkhuni Maitreya Bodhisattva. Or something. See, I've arrived. Okay, but self-doubt it is. Yes, you can. And if you think you can, you do. It's amazing. If you think you can't, you won't. And people have. You know, the most amazing people have come on this retreat and got jhanas. And I don't say that easily, because the story was, some years ago, I think it was an Easter retreat, I was actually near the office when people were registering, and this big guy came in, you know, full of tattoos, and tattoos all over him, and I stereotyped him, and I said, sir, you've gone to the wrong place, the prison is up the road. Because we look like someone visiting a prison, some big bikey, you know, tattoos all over, really sort of strong, big broke. And he sort of said, no, I'm on the retreat. He said his name, he was down there. So I thought, well, you know, why not? Everyone, you know, may all beings be happy and well, no discrimination. But didn't have much hope for him with that sort of lifestyle which I thought tattoos gave you. But then he came to me after 4 or 5 days and said, oh, I had a nice experience. And I looked at him and just... He checked and said, wow, I was blown away. So that was a jhana. You did it. But one of the last people I would have said could do it. And there he wasn't. And it was his first retreat. Other people, you know, wearing white clothes, like some Buddhist yoga, keeping 8 precepts, always there in the meditation early in the morning, and opening the door for me and just doing all nice things. They were getting nowhere. And this guy, so the meaning of that, if you want to get jhanas, go and get a tattoo. No, that's not the meaning, but it was amazing, that's what happened. Unexpected. So, you know, he learned, knew how to let go, and just did it. So that's why, if he can do that, you can. Why the precept no eating afternoon except chocolate and cheese? Oh, because... Just imagine you had to be cooking in the evening for your evening meal. Then you'd be here about 5 o'clock and you'd be smelling, I wonder what they're cooking for this evening. And then you'd be walking past there and think, oh, that smells good. And basically your meditation from 4 till 6 will be shot, thinking about the food. So your food just is all over in one go or 2 goes. And then in the evening, your stomach is free. Free, so all the blood can go to your brain instead of to your tummy. which means you're more alert, more opportunity to be mindful. With regard to the right view discussion, could you please discuss your opinion or view of the practice of vipassana according to the Goenka tradition, emphasizing Vedana, the second Satipatthana, and the emphasis on the arising and passing of Vedana kalapas? Number one, where should we get onto this later on? Rising and passing that's not what the Satipatthana says. That's one of those wrong translations. What it actually says is causes for things coming into being and causes for them to disappear. It's not like rise and fall, it's cause. And the cause for things to vanish. That's the samudaya and atagama. And the vipassana practice, in emphasizing Vedana, it is, there is no wisdom without jhanas. I'll come there, it says it so often. That's why it's in the Eightfold Path, jhanas. And I will also give the quote later on in the word of the Buddha. This comes from the Gopika Moggallana Sutta, where it says that just after the Buddha's Parinibbana, the go-to monk was Ananda, because he'd been there sitting with the Buddha for 25 years. And so people asked Ananda, what type of meditation did the Buddha praise? And the answer was, the Buddha only praised and recommended four types of meditation. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. It's pretty strong evidence. If you actually read the suttas, even for yourself, and you see there that the jhana tradition was a Buddhist tradition. I don't mind being controversial, except that sometimes this time of night it makes people think and stay awake all night. Dear Ajahn, I'm still living with my parents and have been in a dilemma, contemplating whether I should move out. One other solution is you stay home and move your parents out. Think outside the box. So you can suggest to your parents, why don't you go to ordain? We're having our Katina ceremony soon. So, both in here and in Dhammasara. So, for your Katina offering, you can offer your father to Bodhinyana and your mother to Dhammasara. Now, what a wonderful thing it is, your opportunity to actually gain enlightenment, fast track. And then you have the house by yourself. No, that's only joking. Don't quote me on that. Otherwise, people will say, actually, Brian, you're supposed to be a monk, no respect for the elderly. That's actually why I get a senior's card, see if it works. On one hand, I really would like to spend more time with my aging parents, and I feel that they prefer that I stay with them. On the other hand, I sometimes struggle living with them due to lack of freedom and having to live up to their expectations. Hence a lot of friction and unhappiness. What should I do? Please advise. Thank you. Singapore is really good in that sense that they give you a tax credit if you live, I think, within 1 kilometre or 2 kilometres of your parents. So you don't have to live at home, but you live close enough in case they need you, which is really nice. So you have a bit of freedom, but you also have the care as well. See if you can find both. The old compromise. Would your advice be the same, given if recently my dad just suffered a mild stroke and even more expects me to live with him? But I feel the pressure and built up frustration in me that often cause uncontrollable flare-ups of my poor parents. I'm not sure which is better, more out of continue living with them. It's a guilt trap either way. You can always find a compromise. So I don't know just, you know, your income or something, but sometimes getting a carer in. It's called respite. So that, you know, you can come, obviously, you know, you're here in Bodhinyana Jhana Grove, if you wrote this. So that, you know, you've abandoned your parents for 9 days, but it means you become a much better carer when you go back. So it's wonderful to be able to find sort of that middle way there. So you can care for your parents, but not at your expense. In other words, not so you get sort of of heart attack and frustration and angry. So care for yourself, care for others, balance compassion and duties, and then you'll be fine. What happens to the unspent karma, good or bad, when an arahat passes away? The unspent karma goes to the karma bank, like unspent money. It all gets recycled and destroyed, like unused notes, and gets composted. Is that an idea? No, it just disappears. What arises is of the nature to cease. Even karma. It's not permanent. It's not everlasting. So even karma can niroda, vanish, pass away. And actually, even now you can let go of karma. Sometimes I say that all the bad karma we've made, all the guilt, remorse, all the bad memories, that is like a boat, like one of these tugboats you see in the Straits of Singapore, putting one of these big boats. That's, you're the tug, and this huge cargo ship is all your bad karma. And so any time you can just cut the cord and let it go. You don't have to keep carrying all those memories. It's so wonderful when you can let that go. You feel you can do that. You don't have to keep carrying the past. You don't learn from the mistakes of the past. You learn from the freedom of the present moment. That's where you learn. Now. Not from the past. Certainly not from the future. I still have thoughts. So why do we have these moments of incredible spontaneous joy? Very unlike low-grade happiness. How is this possible? Don't I need stillness for this? If you add stillness, then you'll have double the joy. So you ain't seeing nothing yet, mate. You get into stillness, and that joy will really blow your mind. So you get some joy. If you do get that joy, the joy should also create more stillness. You're just happy being here. I don't need anything. No goals, got joy. This is good enough for me. So joy is also a cause for stillness. Satisfaction, contentment, nothing to do. Ho-hum. If there is no will, then no one is at fault for committing a crime. Either conditionality that forced me to commit crime. Is it correct? Yes, and there's no one who goes to jail. So when they put you into jail, sort of for committing a crime, it's fair. No one did it. And no one is going to jail. You can't have it both ways. I remember this nice cartoon of a hypnotist, a very famous hypnotist, who had done some sort of crime. And the judge said, Zappo, the great hypnotist, you've been convicted of this terrible fraud, and I sentence you to 6 months in the Bahamas at the taxpayers' expense with first-class tickets and a first-class hotel. He was a hypnotist. He hypnotized the judge. So if soul equals consciousness, if not, what is consciousness? What is soul? What one dies, the soul lives, or the consciousness lives? Neither. It's a stream, a flow, a process. Just like the old simile, you stand on a bridge, and you watch the river underneath. It looks the same, doesn't it? Looks the same, but it's totally different than the water which flowed even a few minutes ago. The stream of consciousness. And that doesn't lead a body to continue on. In fact, when a person has out-of-the-body experiences, when they die, they create what we call mind-made body. It's weird, but it seems to take on the characteristics or the form of when you die. For example, a nice ghost story. What are you laughing at? Most people, but true one. This fellow a long time ago, Victor, and he was a builder, and he brought one of his friends for some counselling. His friend was a builder in the town of Kalgoorlie, which is about 600 kilometres from here or something. It's a gold mining town in the bush. And being an Aussie builder, when he came to see me, he wore, you know, because, you know, out of respect, a traditional Australian costume. The national dress of Australia. Shorts, singlet, and rubber thongs. That's Australian national dress. And they just really just, just a hard-working sort of Australian builder. And, he had cancer, so I gave him some tips and advice and meditation and stuff. And a few weeks later, he died. It was over in Kalgoorlie. And so, mate Victor went to go and to the funeral, and then came back again. A few days later, he came to the monastery that morning. He said, last night, I was in bed with my wife, and I turned around and to scold my wife for elbowing me, in the sleep. I realized it wasn't her. And I saw it was my mate who just died. It was in Kalgoorlie, but it was actually next to my bed. And he said, but what was really weird was that he was wearing a fine suit with a polka dot bow tie. He said that was, inconceivable. In all the time they met each other, he never ever, even when they went out for dinner, never ever wore a suit or a bow tie. He was an Aussie, just wear his shorts and singlet, comfortable. And so, as soon as he saw him, very clearly, he turned to his wife, hey, it's, I forget what it was, Jim or something, who just passed away. And then, because he turned to his wife, when he turned back again, the apparition had disappeared. And really stupid, then they went around the house looking for him. But anyway, he came to see me later on. And said, what happened? Because it was him, I could recognize his face, but his dress was totally out of character. You know what I said? I said, look, maybe a couple of days, or maybe tomorrow, ring up the widow. You're a friend, so how are you going? Is there anything I could do for you? Just make small talk. And then just ask, just as a matter of interest, now what was he wearing in his coffin? Because it was a closed coffin. Just to find out, but no leading questions. And he came back afterwards, he said, it was amazing. He did that conversation. Now, what was he wearing? He said he was wearing a suit and a polka dot bow tie. He said, well, he never worn that before. He said, yes, I bought it for him years ago, and he would refuse to wear it, and I thought at least he could wear it in his coffin. And how he could know that was impossible. And I said, how he appeared. So, if you die right now, Venerable Chanda, you will have a beanie and a blanket around you when you appear to see people. So be careful when you die to make sure you have a good shave and wearing nice clothes. Otherwise, that will be how you appear to your friends. But actually, that was interesting. You take on the form when you die of what's in the coffin. Fascinating, isn't it? So anyway, more like that fellow who, he was another business person. But one of these people who just did not want to waste money. No charity, no trying to get out of giving taxes. Just really, really ungenerous. And so when he was about to die, he told his wife. He said, look, when you put me in my coffin, I want to be buried without any clothes. Naked. He said, look, I know you don't like wasting anything, but surely I can actually put you in something in your coffin. He said, no, it's not because I'm trying to save money. is because, well, I know my conduct. I know where I'm going to go after I die, and you don't need any clothes down there. It's hot enough as it is. So, you know, what can you do to your last will and testament of your husband? So, buried him naked. And 3 days later, he appeared naked in her bedroom. Because that's actually how you buried or cremated or put in the box, that's how you appear. And he asked her, he said, darling, have you got any of my clothes left? Have you got the old jumpers and trousers and a few socks? He said, what do you want those for? I thought you went down to hell. He said, yes, I'm down in hell. But there's so many rich people down there, they've installed aircon. Okay, that's a joke. Okay, I better carry on because I'll get this to me. My teenage son is constantly driving my wife crazy. How to help her if she refuses to listen to your Dharma talks? If he refuses to listen to the Dharma talks, what you can do is, when she's asleep at night, just start playing those Dharma talks at a subliminal level, you know, just get into her brain. So like brainwashing. And that means that, you know, she starts to sort of laugh in her sleep and it gets into there. Is that really immoral, do you think? But actually, sometimes, you know, if you're listening to that talk, maybe just with earpods, you know, not the earbuds. And if it's really funny and laughing, it's amazing. If it's profound, people aren't all that interested. But if you're laughing, ha 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 ha, then actually they'll be interested. So what are you listening to? Oh, it's none of your business. It's, you know, I laugh some more. So what are you listening to? As you're laughing and smiling, oh, no, none of your business. So make them interested. And then, sort of, they want to listen. That is why I do tell jokes. I learned that from a Tibetan monk. And the Tibetan monk said that when I make people laugh with a joke or funny story, when they have their mouths open, that's when I can throw in the pill of Dharma. Oh, that's wonderful. Anyway, if karma is volition and volition is karma, how does bad karma arise from negligence or ignorance? It's negligence of not listening to the Dhamma and not allowing yourself to be brainwashed, not going to the temple enough. Negligence of not listening to the teaching of aliens. That influences you. Sometimes people say, oh, all these different traditions are different. In Tibetan Buddhism we have, what is it, the transference of, what do you call it, not initiations. Yeah. Sorry? Initiations. But they have like the transference of something from teacher to student. It's not transference, what is it called? Trans something anyway. Some transactions sometimes in some temples. Transmission, yes. Oh, that's a transaction. No, that's in dodgy temples. No transmission without transaction. So, anyway, for the transmission, people think that's a Tibetan thing. It's straight down the line Theravada as well. Listening to the teachings of enlightened beings. And there's something in it just gets transmitted across. That is how ignorance is broken. You can't do it yourself. You need something outside of yourself. You can't do it. Your mouth can't eat your own head. That's why you need teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha had the memory of the teachings of Kassapa, because he was a monk under Kassapa before. This Kassapa the Buddha, this is actually how it works. It's all conditioning and brainwashing. That's where it comes from. You can't do it yourself. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do you accept Samaya's a spouse who is determined to leave you because he, she cannot forgive the wrongs you've done? Should I let her go or try harder to make things work? Okay, the wrongs that you have done. Who was it? That was, I think it was ABC told me that story. I'm not sure it was a personal story. I should actually ask her about the when she got married, and her father took aside her new husband, new groom, and gave him some father-in-law advice. So, you probably think my daughter is perfect. And he said, oh yes, she's such a wonderful catch. I'm so lucky to have married her. She's the most beautiful, charming, wonderful, perfect woman in the whole world. At which the father said, yeah, that's what it's like when you first fall in love. But after a couple of years, you will begin to see the faults and defects in my daughter. But I want you to remember this, son-in-law. If she didn't have those faults and defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you. That's really funny. We look at all the wrongs which you've done. But has she seen the wrongs which she did? It's her fault. She decided to marry you. So in other words, fault finding doesn't get you anywhere. Blaming somebody else doesn't get you anywhere. And we spend so much time blaming other people. So, Ajahn Chah used to say, if you blame other people, pointing out the wrongs that other people have done, it's like having an itch on your head and you scratch your bum. The itch doesn't go away, but you get two itches. So, you don't. If the problem is, you know, that she is unhappy, or he is unhappy with you, it doesn't get you anywhere just to leave. There was these two sisters who came to see me many years ago. Actually, one of them was there, I think, was it today or yesterday? And one of them was married and was having so much trouble with her husband. And she was asking me that, you know, should I leave my husband? Causing me so much problems and trouble. And when I tried to, you know, just counsel her and just don't be so forthright, look at his nice side. Then I turned to her sister, and her sister's problem was that she could never find a stable partner in life. She'd be going out with a nice guy, maybe 3 weeks, a month, and it'd all fall apart. It happened again and again and again. She just couldn't find a partner in life. So, you know, one of them had a husband she didn't want, and the other one wanted a husband. And I found the perfect logical solution, being a scientist and a man. And they thought it was stupid. So you've got a husband you don't want, your sister wants one, give yours to her. Let's go share, that's sisterly love. Don't you share things amongst your brothers and sisters? I said, no. And then I said, you sister who's got a husband you're having a problem with, you've got what we call married person suffering. You've got marriage dukkha. And you, who is single, you've got single woman suffering. So look, you, if you get rid of your husband, you'll get what your sister has, single woman suffering. And you, when you get a husband, you get what your older sister has, you get marriage suffering. So I said, okay, we'll become nuns. When you become a nun, you won't have like lay woman suffering, you'll have nun suffering. You know what that's all about. And then, do I remember that? When I was a very young monk in Thailand, I was really thin, and all the monks at the top of the line, they got the best food. I mean, so we got what was left over. You know the line sometimes the people who get to the top of the line first, they get all the best food, you have to get the leftovers. And that was me as a young monk. And I thought, all the monks are the top of the line. They're all enlightened anyway. You know, I've just come in. I've got greed. You know, I'm hungry. It doesn't matter with Ajahn Chah. I was already enlightened. So, you know, we should go to the line first of all. And also, all those senior monks had the biggest cushions. And me, I was all skin and bone, because, you know, eating frogs and stuff, and really thin, working hard, I had to sit on the hard concrete. It was really unfair. And all those senior monks, they make the decisions where you put that pile of earth, they make us do the work. And all those senior monks, they'd be sitting, they wouldn't do any work, they'd be just sitting there talking to people all day. I thought it was really unfair. I had what was called junior monk suffering. Now I'm an old monk, and I think, why do I have to spend all day drinking tea and talking to people? I want to do some exercise. Why do I have to sit at the front of the line and people say, oh, no, this muffin is really good for you, you must take it, or this bananas are really good, you have to eat this. And that's why I get fat, too much compassion. So I've got what's now called senior monk suffering. So you don't escape suffering, you just change the flavour. So better the suffering you have than the suffering which you think you won't have if you go somewhere else. So, the job you got now. I don't want this job. I want to become a monk. I want to leave. And then you find out, you know, I was thinking, there was one of the monks, sort of, disrobed a few weeks ago, we were thinking. So, you know, in the Singapore, Malaysia, Thai tradition, we can have temporary ordinations. You know, temporary ordinations where you come along and become a monk or a nun just for a couple of weeks, a novice or a month, just to test it out. Have you ever done that? And I thought that sometimes for monks or nuns who want to leave, wouldn't it be wonderful to have like temporary disrobal? So you just find out what it's like to work hard in the world and not to actually be served and not to have all the perks of being a monk or a nun. Find out. And I'm sure if that happened, most monks will not disrobe. Because sometimes it's always the grass on the other side of the fence is greener. When I get rid of this, then I won't have any suffering. It's never like that. It's always you just exchange one form of suffering for another. When I become rich, when I win the lottery, then I won't have any suffering anymore. Ha ha ha. You've seen people who've won the lottery? Some of them go crazy. They have rich people suffering. So, this is no way to escape from suffering, exchanging one form for another form. Instead, we go much deeper. It's the wanting to be different. It's the aversion. I don't like this, I want to be somewhere else. What I said this afternoon, a prison is any place you don't want to be. Even in a 5-star hotel. And freedom is being happy to be here. No matter where you are, what your body, what your job, what your pain, what your duties. Happy to be here. Happy to be a senior monk who gets exploited like hell. Happy to be a nun who's going over to England. And who knows what's going to happen. Happy to be a lay person sitting here listening to the same old stories and the same old jokes. Anyway, that's what we do. I'd better always do this and just spend all the time on the first few questions and do so quick. How do you disengage from something that is happening to you? Easy. It's not happening to you, it's happening to your five components of existence, your five khandhas, there's no you. So you just watch it and let it go. None of your business. It passes by itself. What is the Buddhist perspective on plants, bacteria, virus, etc.? Can streams of consciousness be reborn into these life forms? Oh yeah, you know, if you're there's a little plant forms, there's a little I think, did we put it in the kitchen, I think, about the squirrel. You are what you eat. So the squirrel becomes nuts. Streams of consciousness be reborn in this life form. So if you eat many nuts, that's what you become, that's what you associate with, and so that's what you get reborn as. Now, stream of consciousness get reborn into these life forms. That's very difficult. But the Buddha says that, you know, plants have a rudimentary sense of consciousness. But plants and bacteria, there's no such really hard and fast line between plant life and animal life. There's things like, you know, I always remember the Venus flytrap. There's plants, animals, which, you know, lie almost in between. Or like even ants. You know, the over in Bodhinyana, one of the Anagarikas once gave an ant an intelligence test. So you know the ant hills, there were small holes. They put a sugar cube on top of the ant hill to see what they would do. Now, of course, the sugar cube, it is too hard for the ants to pull apart. But you know, it's a great food source for them. So he was amazed that over maybe 8 or 9 days, what these ants did, great engineers, they excavated from underneath the sugar cube. And day by day, it got down, 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 until it was so low, then they put the earth on top. That way, they took the sugar cube down, deep, 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 into their mound, where they could use it as a source of food later on. Amazing ants could work together and think like that. And apparently that's how the Viet Cong would actually take an American tank and actually take it underground. With no heavy equipment, they just excavate it slowly from underneath and then they bury it in their tunnels. That's amazing. The intelligence of animals is huge. And so I was actually astounded the ants could actually organize something they hadn't faced before and could actually find a very, very engineering solution to it. Anyway, how about inanimate objects? Even Earth has been called a living planet, alive and evolving. Does it have consciousness? It may have some sort of consciousness, but it doesn't last, because even the great Earth will one day disappear. So it is not going to... But sometimes it's nice to think of things with consciousness. Even like a machine, like your car. It's happened many, many times. The machine which I tended to regard as having consciousness and feelings was the old cement mixer. I already mentioned that I have done so much work, building work in this place. We had a cement mixer. It was my cement mixer. I had it purchased, chose it, and did most of the mixing in there. Other monks sometimes couldn't get it to work. And I would go over there, stroke it, and then gently put it. It would work every time for me. And people thought that's really, really weird. Or, I think you saw this, Anusha, in the Kalyanamitta group with Veronica, Ronnie. I was coming back from like doing a house blessing or something, and the Kalyanamitta group were about to go to the beach or something, and then but the boot of their car was locked and they couldn't open it up, and I don't know how long you've been trying there, and it was Veronica's car, Roddy's car. She's Mrs. Grumpy, the first Grumpy license. And I came along and said, "Oh, here comes Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, can you open the car for us, please?" And said, "What's in it for me?" He said, and I said, "If you promise to become a nun, a bhikkhuni, I will open the car for you." And she thought I couldn't do it. I turned the lock, but you know, just was very kind to the car, and it opened for me first time. True story? Absolutely true. She was very embarrassed. She had to become a nun. But fortunately, there was a lawyer in the youth group. And the lawyer said, "You know, I can get you off this." Because, yes, she promised to become a nun, but she never said in which lifetime. And I told you that story of the ATM, loving kindness to an ATM. That's in one of the books. This German fellow, he just gave loving kindness to an ATM, and the ATM, when he needed it, gave him $20. It just came out without anyone pressing any buttons. Nice ATM, maybe happy and well. Oh, not $20, it was 20 euros. And no one had seen it there. It's amazing. So the interaction between the mind and machines. So machines have artificial intelligence? Maybe they do. Anyway, I better carry on here, otherwise my intelligence will be gone. Can you please explain the concept of mala? Is it just an example to explain obstacles in meditation? In your book, Simply This Moment, you have mentioned that mala lives in the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. Also, if realms are mind-made, i.e. human realm mind-made, is human realm mind-made too? And if that's the case, we are trying to figure out by understanding the Dhamma, sadhu. So yeah, mara, the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, means the realm of those who exert power over other people's creations. The control freak in chief, I call mara. Which is why when you let go and the will vanishes in jhana, because there's no will left, that's why mara can't control anything. They call that, that's where mind, mara gets blindfolded. Cannot see you, cannot append to you. Because there's no will for mara to work with. Fascinating. And when we moved our city centre from North Perth to its present location, there was Dr. Kesari Dhammananda in Brickfields Temple in Malaysia was very impressed. Because the sabha was no la mara. Which means no, definitely no mara. You know the Singlish, always saying la on the end of things. Nice dinner la. Nice retreat centre la. No la, mara. So, yes, yeah, mind made. Because we each live in our different worlds. We're all in Jhana Grove. But your reality of what Jhana Grove is different from every person. We make our worlds. Can you guide me how to handle fly insects when meditating in the wood? It's a waste of time just flipping them away because they're too fast for you. So, instead, you can actually... The best way is, because when I was in the jungles in Thailand, so many mosquitoes, and we weren't allowed to swat them. So I decided just to meditate, just let it be, don't fight. And then it got so peaceful, you go inside, the body disappears. And afterwards, when I came out, there was no mosquito bites. It was amazing. And I found out afterwards, I thought it was psychic powers or some power of samadhi. But what it really was, the more you worry and get anxious about things like mosquitoes or other flies, the more carbon dioxide comes out of your pores and the more you're advertising yourself to those flies, because that's what attracts them. They're drawn to the carbon dioxide coming out. So if you're so still, your metabolism goes way down. Then they can't find you, you disappear. The more you worry about them, the more they find you. The more still you are, they can't find you at all. Interesting Dhamma there. But anyway, just wear a fly net or something, or come and meditate in here. And if you want to meditate in the wood, just take a few sticks into your kuti or your hut and just imagine you're in the wood. It doesn't need to be a tree, it's kind of wood. The sutta class today mentions not pursuing happiness through the five senses, and one of the ways to the cessation of suffering. I know this is silly, but my heart wants and chooses to watch movie in flight, eat the tea break of cheese and chops, not out of need, but greed for the taste, etc. How should I train myself? Go the opposite with what the heart wants. Is it your heart wants this? There is pleasure in these things, but there's also the dangers, the downside to it. So you find, you know, enough of the food, enough of the entertainment, enough of the sleeping, just the right amount, the middle way. So you just don't get, that's right, what was one of the monks, a long time ago. You know, he wanted to come to the monastery to ordain, but he'd watched all the Harry Potter movies, except the last one. And he said, if I become a monk now, I won't be able to see the final episode. So he put off his ordination. Until he could catch the last episode of Harry Potter. That's a danger. You get attached to these things. So, let's see the danger in sensory pleasures. And then, you know, you think, well, is it really worth it? Meditation can help me see anger arise, so it helps me to reduce my anger before it happens. How meditate can help me reduce greed? You can see greed before it happens. Why do we need to do this? You don't need to own things to be happy. Because sometimes people say, I get a nice big house with a nice big garden and a swimming pool. You don't need that in Singapore. If you want a swimming pool, you can get the swim in the river or by the ocean for free. A garden, you can go to the park. You don't have to look after it. So people these days are much smarter. If you know they want to have a house with views. What are you talking about, views? Get sort of someone to paint something on the ceiling for you. That's a view. So sometimes people are very not smart and they have a big house with a garden when there's a big park next door which somebody else looks after for free. So you just go in there. Like in Perth, King's Park, you can just walk wherever you want. And if you want a sort of a swimming pool, there's many swimming pools in Perth, somebody else maintains, you don't have to keep cleaning it yourself. So why do you want a big house with a big garden, a big pool? Just only to impress other people, that's all. So you don't really need it. It's just, look, I've made it, look at me. So that's why sometimes downsizing, having small things, is much better. So that's, you see, greed, and what I want it for. I am a working single mum. At home I set rules, the boundaries. I am the cook, the doctor, the nurse, the taxi driver. I kiss bruises, give hugs, everything. But are you the doctor to yourself, your own nurse? Do you actually drive yourself crazy, or do you drive yourself into peace? I kiss bruises. I already said you can't kiss your own elbow. Or give hugs. Do you give yourself a hug? You know, sometimes there's no one to give you a hug. And as a monk, it's really difficult. I can't give a woman a hug. And if I give a man a hug these days, people again think, you know, what type of monk are you? So these days, to make sure that nobody misunderstands, and if I need a hug, everybody needs a hug from now and again, even a monk. So what I do, if you need a hug, you can follow me, put your arms out, and you bring them in, and give yourself a hug. Oh, that's a problem, you work too hard, but I really love you. You tell these rotten jokes, but you know. Get into it. Give yourself a hug, for goodness sake. And you can actually do this, and it feels good. And you don't catch any diseases, and people don't get the wrong idea. So, is it okay if I don't get everything right in this retreat? I'm doing no intentional harm. It's amazing. Oh, I've got something else here. I'm here to have a mental break and let go. A mental break is okay, but not a mental break. Now. How do I care for myself and my suffering without hurting or offending others? It's easy. You deserve time out. Thank you for the person for testing my practice. I have a long way to go. You haven't got a long way to go. You're here. You've arrived, baby. You've arrived. So, don't feel guilty. Don't measure. You deserve some peace. So you can always give yourself a hug. And you're not a single mum. You're a mum with many friends. You're never alone. How can I create the karma so that I can see you again in my next life? Is die tonight and get reborn tomorrow. That's the only way I can think. I wouldn't mind being a monk, but I don't think I can live in the jungle. I am fearful of animals, bugs and insects. What is your recommendation for cultivating fearlessness? Well, there's a lot to be said about living in the jungle. There's lots of animals there, but you know that most of the animals are okay, especially in the jungles in Thailand. But one day, I did come face to face with a tiger. Big tiger. And sometimes you just don't know your reaction. And the tiger was just halfway between you and I. Its nose was here and I was here. And I had no fear at all. Amazing, isn't it? And you think that this huge creature, huge, massive, and there I was, no fear. Was that impressive? But it was actually not in the jungle, it was in a zoo. That was the time I came face to face with a tiger. That's how you overcome fear. To make sure the tiger was behind bars, and then you're safe. But it's also a lot of animals, they're more afraid of you than they are of them. So if there are bugs and insects, they don't know who you are. Okay, nice little story. There was this monk, his name was Ajahn Lee. He was interesting fellow. I'll tell you a few little stories here. He was a disciple of Ajahn Mun, but he actually went down to Bangkok and actually just got that forest tradition acceptable to the elite in Thailand. And he made his monastery in just south of Bangkok, Samut Pagan, and he called it Asoka Rama Temple. That was actually the temple which Asoka built I think it was Pataliputra in Patna. That was his main temple there. And it's amazing that he would call it Asoka Rama. It was totally different to any other type of Thai temple. But it was more. In Ubon, he was giving a talk. Many people saw this. And from the roof, out of nowhere, a medallion fell down. It's in his museum of Emperor Asoka. And the monks who stayed with him said, actually, that's who he was in the previous life. Now, Asoka was a famous person. And people who say they were Napoleon in the past life or something, you know, they're usually a bit crazy. But this was actually a person who's a great meditator. And you have to take some of that stuff seriously. That's why he called it Asoka Rama, his temple. Strange. But anyway, one of his stories, he was in the jungles meditating. And the villagers, you'd actually announce to the villagers that you're going to, you're staying there, because then they'd prefer food for you in the morning. On arms round, otherwise they wouldn't know you were there. You wouldn't get anything except rice. And so he told the villagers, and they said, oh yeah, we'll give you something to eat, but can we actually just come and listen to a Dhamma talk from you in a couple of hours' time? And so, yeah, that's what we used to do. So, you know, you give them a little Dhamma talk, or maybe answer some questions, or meditate together in the evening. So he had a couple of hours, and so he started meditating under a tree. And after a couple of minutes, he realized it was the wrong tree. Because there was a big ant mound close by. Red ants. Really biting hard. And they started crawling all up his legs and biting him. Crawling and crawling up. And the next thing he knew, he was about 10 meters away running. He didn't know actually how that happened. His mindfulness was just so obsessed by the pain that he just ran. But then he stopped and said, no, I'm a forest monk. I'm not going to run away from this. So he went back down and sat gently down in the same spot. This huge swarm of red ants. They don't make monks like that these days. But he changed his meditation object. Instead of anapanasati on the breath, he started doing loving kindness. May all ants be happy and well. Have a good feed. You must be very hungry. The door of my heart's open to you no matter what you do. And of course, after a little while, they stopped biting him. And then he actually said he felt all the ants crawling down his legs and off his body. And then he went into a very nice deep meditation. When the 2 hours were up, he opened his eyes and he heard the villagers coming to listen to the Dhamma talk. But all the villagers were dancing. And he thought, oh, a strange custom in this part of Thailand. When they come to listen to a Dhamma talk, they do a dance. And he realized they were dancing because the red ants were just biting the hell out of him, out of the villagers. But he noticed around him there was like a 1 meter radius circle, like a no man's land. The ants were protecting him. It was weird. He gave so much kindness to the animals that the animals not only stopped biting him, but protecting him. And that's like a true story. That's what happens with loving kindness. So if you do go into the jungles where there's wild animals, you have to have so much loving kindness, and that protects you. And the animals will protect you. So many interesting jungle stories. There's one monk that he was living in a jungle for a long time. And one day, it's a really sad story, beautiful story though. There was someone knocked on his door. Anyone in the jungle. It wasn't a ghost, it was one of the monkeys. It was holding a stillborn baby monkey. And the mother monkey was crying and just handed it to the monk, basically saying, do something. You know, even the monkeys, forget what species was, she was grief-stricken. And so, thinking maybe the monk could bring the child to life. And so the monk took the little baby, I think did some chanting and gave it back and tried to console, the mother monkey. And become part of the jungle and the animals respect you. It's a beautiful story. But unfortunately the monk couldn't do anything. Last year I killed over 50 cockroaches within one night. Oh my goodness, they're coming for revenge. The revenge of the cockroaches. No. Anyway. Right after that, I dreamed of having a skin disease. My skin was blackened and crisp. I felt bad for killing the cockroaches and afraid the skin disease might come true because of the bad karma. I tried hard not to kill after that incident, but how can I lighten the bad karma? Forgiveness. Sometimes, why you did that out of fear, but the cockroaches won't harm you. They go to where they go, and you go to where you go. So, you're not cockroach food. So, that way that you can actually have this beautiful symbiosis. They do what they have to do, you do what you have to do. And just ask forgiveness. Say, cockroaches, I'm sorry, that's the best I could do. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I'll try not to do that again. So just forgive, acknowledge your mistake, forgive, and learn. So try not to have to do that again. How do you define a good life? By being a good person. Good people have a good time. I'm a good time monk. I have a good time. Because I'm good. So you be good. Oh, wait, sorry. What is one? Is it breaking the precept to use psychology or reverse psychology to make people do what you want them to do? If that was the case, I'd be breaking precepts, and so would the Buddha. No, we use psychology to make people do what you want them to do. Not what you want them to do, but you help them. It's called compassion. So may all beings be happy and well, and you use some psychology to actually to encourage them to be better human beings. Sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, because of your teaching, you've changed my life. And I say, for the better or for the worse? It's easy for the good. For the six realms of samsara, what is a demigod realm and how is that different from the deva realm? Demigods? Half gods? Asuras! Yes. Asuras are supposed to be very aggressive beings. And the whole idea of Sura, there's a town in Indonesia called Surabaya, and that comes from Abaya means like danger, and Sura means alcohol. So it means danger, beware of alcohol. That's Surabaya. It doesn't mean that at all. But when I said that, that's, you know, in Sanskrit, that actually works. So, you know, Handaka of Haipasika, he thought that was really funny. So, demigod is the Asuras. Oh, they're just beings who think that fighting is heaven. You ask Ajahn Brahmali, you know, he's Norwegian, and in the Viking mythology, all the best heroes who die in battle with a sword in their hand go to Valhalla. It's the hall of, I think, Val or something. But anyway, in Norse mythology, when they die in Valhalla, they have, it's interesting, no women. They have a big feast, lots and lots of whale or something, I don't know what they eat. Ask Ajahn Brahmali. Lots of food. And then they have, and lots of alcohol. And then they have a fight and they all die. And then they get reborn again and start all over again in Valhalla. Just food, drink, and fighting. That's a true Viking. And that's their heaven realm. So he's gone to Valhalla for more fighting, more eating, and more drinking. Eternal. So people will have their own. So sometimes people think that fighting is heaven. Even when I was a kid, there was, you know, a young man growing up, there were some pubs in London where there would always be a fight. People went there for a fight. They thought that was fun. Other places were peaceful. So people chose. They wanted to fight. Crazy, isn't it? If we could not attain enlightenment this life, which are the safer realms to be reborn in? What do you mean if you could? You can, but you might not. Everyone can, but most people won't. But you can. I am taking a course on Anapanasati meditation in Singapore. A course. The teacher tells us to use methods like counting and naming the breath for a start. But in this retreat, your instructions are not to think, not to focus on anything. Just listen to what the body wants. How can I reconcile these? Both are okay. But here, counting stuff, that all comes from books. What I'm teaching here is much, much more, not just counting the breath, but why and how. And what's the purpose of this? Getting actually to some more basics. Because so if you go counting the breath, just some people just, they're accountants in their daily life, and the last thing they want to do when they're on retreat is count again. And anyway, some people lost count, and they have to get a calculator out, beating in one, beating out one, one, two, two. They keep it simple. So it's easy actually to reconcile. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I kill mosquitoes because I'm afraid they spread dengue fever. Is this bad karma? You know, I was in Thailand for so many years, and there's places where I had, what's it called, malaria fever. I never caught it at all. Is it malaria? Is it mosquitoes spread dengue fever? Is it? Or is it fear spreads dengue fever? When you see your loved one spiral downhill emotionally, you try to care for them, tell them to go to the temple, listen to Dharma, etc., but they won't listen. What do you do to lessen your suffering when caring is not enough? Again, you tell people, oh, don't go to the temple, don't listen to the Dharma, because sometimes loved ones will do things out of spite just to
to not do what you would tell them to do. So when you don't want to spiral downhill emotionally, sometimes just not telling them what to do, but actually giving them this space of support. Why are they spiraling emotionally downhill? Sometimes it's because they're trying to get better. And so just say, it's okay, it will pass. And so give them means. Don't tell them what to do. Give them means so that they can learn to find strategies. Now, one thing is just always, how big is my hand? My hand is so big I can't see any of you. You put it out here somewhere. Yeah, you've got a problem, but it's not everything. My hand is still the same size all the time. Now I can't see anything except my hand. Now I can see everyone here and my hand as well. So emotionally spiraling downhill is basically just having just the wrong perspective. Obsessing. Thinking it will last forever, sorry. But after a while, it passes. But that's a big question. But when you're suffering, when caring is not enough, compassion is not always enough unless you have wisdom. You need both of them together, compassion and wisdom. Skillful means, sometimes even going to a doctor and just asking them please, can you care for my loved one? Because it spirals downhill, but when you get to the lowest point downhill, then you go up again. Happy birthday, Tauli. Where is she? Tauli. Come and admit it. So, she's 26 today. For the second time. So, it's your birthday today. So, you spent your birthday... Oh, I see. Do you believe in distant healing? Does it work that a mass prayer or someone does praying even help on a smaller scale? In one sense, yes, it does help, because especially if people know that people are caring for you, then it works. It just encourages people. But it's even more powerful than that, that sometimes at a distance people can feel your loving kindness. But maybe this is when we do loving kindness meditation sometime in this retreat, hopefully. Maybe you have an Alexis. Well, I'll just tell you about it now. Sometimes on loving kindness meditation, I ask people to send their loving kindness, when it's nice and strong, to someone a long way away. And I take the time. It was at 9:38. And then later on, I ask you to call them. Said, next day, just ordinary conversation. Said, oh, just by the way, what were you doing, Monday evening? And it's amazing just how many people call me up afterwards and say, it worked. I just said, oh, that's really strange. You say, about that time I was thinking about you. I was in trouble and thinking about you just made me feel so good. It works. You can experiment on it. You can try it. You know, when you've got strong meditation, think about, your wife, wherever she happens to be, and then spread really strong loving kindness towards her. Note the time and see if she felt it. They do. Anyway, distant healing is not as good this evening as distant sleeping. It's 9:39. I've gone over time. So have you for listening. So thank you all for listening. So now is the time to do flat out meditation. In other words, take a nice rest. Sadhu. 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 Now, it happens at retreats that we get lots and lots of questions. So we're getting a bit too many questions now, but I try and respect the questions. So from tonight on, only one question per person, please. And if you put a question in the box, and before the evening you think, oh, I'd have another question, get your old question out and replace it with a new one. But only one question per person, please. And by one question per person, I don't mean 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D. Okay. Have a good night, everybody. Oh, but oh. Well, throw away this time, otherwise get in trouble. That's weepy. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had one last year. We went through this last time. So, I'll see if we can find a copy of what we did last time. Instead of reinventing the wheel. So, it was done before, so it'd be either on your database or our database somewhere. And we could just recreate it, just change the numbers.
Excellent.
Okie dokie.
Okay. Much more sort of open.
Oh, good.
Excellent, great. Oh, yeah, that's for tomorrow. That's a good, yeah. I've just killed my master. Some people are gluttons for punishment.